This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
Good afternoon, you're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And today we are broadcasting live from Tate Modern as part of Art on Air. And today's Wavelength is ostensibly to launch my new book, Perfect Binding, which is published in an edition of 300. The first 20 copies of the book can be bought from Mr. Ed Baxter, sitting on the front row, who will suck the proceeds into the bottomless pit, which is the Resonance Fund. Several copies have been bought already. There are a few copies floating around the room. If people would like to have a look and seize the opportunity to buy a copy today, who knows, I might even sign one. And I have a guest today, my brother Jack English, a photographer, my elder brother Jack. Hello, Jack.
Hi, William.
And Jack is a major component of this book, which is sort of based around Leicester in the 1960s, where we both came from, or come from. And in theory, Jack is supposed to be interviewing me.
So
I'll hand over now to Jack to ask me difficult questions.
I doubt whether they'll be difficult. I mean, as with all your projects that I've seen, William, that's another hugely original piece of work. And you, as usual, been very true to yourself. And the book, in my opinion, is extraordinary.
Thank you.
And
but
no, there's no buts. There's no buts there. It's a great piece of work, as with all your films and everything that I've ever seen you do. So I suppose I'd better start by asking what inspired you to do the book.
Okay, that's a complicated and difficult question. I suppose originally there was an accumulation of material going back several years, which started, I don't really know quite what the impetus was, but as with resonance, of course, one is looking to do things which are oblique, which kind of go off at a tangent, which are contrary, even. And I suppose several years ago, I've been visiting Leicester frequently, and we have a mutual acquaintance or mutual friend, John Nixon, whose nickname was Jelly, and you were good friends with him in the 60s.
I was.
And you both lived through what is reluctantly labelled sort of the mod era.
Yes.
Which might have sort of, perhaps for you and an elite group of individuals, probably lasted about 6 months. For others, it's lasted 30 years. But for you, it was a very fleeting experience. But I decided that, for me, there was a sort of emblematic or symbolic token, whatever you want like to call it, as the talismanic object for that period, which was a red suede jacket. It seemed that this was synonymous with the appearance of Jelly, who wore this red suede jacket, and that seemed to exemplify a lot of that period, I think. Is that fair?
To a certain extent, yes. I mean, I think it's worth backtracking a little. I, you know, at a very young age was influenced very much by what, another word that I don't really like. I don't like the word mod, but I certainly don't like the word beatniks. But there were a group of guys, Jim Mellors being one of them, who was featured in the book. Dave Robinson, a guy called Finn, and Steve Curtis. And they all used to congregate in a place called the Bond Street Caff. And when they stepped out on the street in the middle of the day in Leicester, they literally stopped the traffic because they had shoulder-length hair, amongst other things. And I was fascinated by these guys. I was probably about 13 at the time.
Yeah.
So that was prior to the mod thing, if you like, coming along. So it was the first thing that I encountered that had an influence on me.
So I then decided to interview Jelly. We should point out that Jelly, in fact, died last year of pancreatic cancer, so he's no longer with us. And in fact, it seems when you get one leafs through the book, I would say probably half the people are no longer with us, unfortunately, for one reason or another. But I did interviews with Jelly, which were in fact broadcast on Resonance very early on, at least over 10 years ago, probably 2005 even. And I also interviewed Bob Hughes, who now lives in Australia, but he's been in touch, and he's also featured in the book. I would say, and I also did two interviews with you, with my brother Jack, which were intended to be about Leicester in the 1960s. But then sort of moved sideways and up and down and around. These might have become a film of some sorts, but Jack didn't like the fact that the low angle of the camera made his hairline look wrong. Then he objected to the surroundings in Claridge's, which were quite noisy, where, of course, you hear the sound of corks popping and ice buckets. And one of the topics that came up, which was of a sensitive nature, and we sort of passed over that. None of these were originally intended as a book, but frequent visits to Leicester then resulted in an interview with Jim Mellors, who at the time was known as Chelsea Jim Mellors, who was sort of Leicester's leading beatnik. He was a surrealist painter.
Yes.
And there's a lengthy interview with Jim, who also died recently. And he latterly became Victoria Ashley. He had a sex change. And then, of course, there was an archive of family photographs. My father had an interest in photography. Personally, I had been taking photographs of the Cameo cinema in the late 1960s, and on visits to Leicester over the years, I took more photographs of the same building, which now only retains a facade. And at one time, the entire building was removed and the facade replaced over a Habitat shop. The gallery of characters throughout the book, the book is called Perfect Binding, and I've got some notes about the book, but perhaps I'll get to that later. Now I should explain first, the book itself, many thanks to Dan Wilson, the designer of the book, who enthusiastically involved himself in the project, even though he has no direct experience of Leicester, and he's the wrong age anyway, he couldn't possibly have known Leicester in the 60s, or anywhere else in the 60s. Or the culture that developed in Leicester in the 1960s. Dan and I, we argued for days over the precise name of the singer in the Chameleon Coffee Bar. Was it Cecile or Cecilia? In the end, Dan was considering tracing her to Trinidad, where she apparently went after leaving Leicester, in case she eventually saw the book and took umbrage at her name being misspelt. Looking at a photograph of Jack English, Steph Rayner, and Jelly in the 1980s, Dan did something that would never have occurred to me, in that he turned the picture upside down and magnified the notebook on the table to see what Jack might have been writing. This was in the 1980s, and it was something that was completely irrelevant to me then and still is now. But Dan has this sort of forensic attitude, and he thought it might reveal some crucial piece of the jigsaw. Dan discovered the Crescent magazine, which is Leicester's only counterculture journal of the 1950s, as far as we know, which led to the editor, known at the time as the Dandy Deceiver, who now lives in Hackney, and so a big thanks to Dan Wilson for all of that. The book itself is 9 inches wide, 12 inches tall, 106 pages, full-colour glossy card covers bound with sewn gatherings, which is contrary to the title Perfect Binding, which refers to a method of bookbinding which in the past was considered a misnomer, to say the least. The name Perfect Binding was applied to books that were held together at the spine by glue only, no stitching. By avoiding stitched gatherings and relying only on glue, after handling and everyday use, the book would be liable to fall apart. The pages would literally part company with the spine, and single pages or sometimes whole sections would come away. The book might look perfect when new, or if not used. These problems have been solved more recently. But perfect binding is generally considered to be an inferior method of constructing a book. So the present book is called Perfect Binding, ironically, referring to something at odds with reality. The title seemed pertinent for more than one reason. It refers obliquely to clothing. So the idea of binding or stitching, holding clothes together, combined with the word perfect, implying a stylistic perfection in attire, which is arguably unattainable and arguably undesirable. A substantial section of the book is concerned with mod culture, that word again, specifically in 1960s Leicester, and the word mod is used reluctantly. Perfect binding can also pertain to the ties that bind. Do you know where that comes from?
The ties that bind?
Yeah.
It sounds familiar, but I can't put my finger on it.
It probably is familiar to you, but you can't... You can't quite put your mind on, you put your finger on it yet.
No.
Okay.
To be honest.
All right. I had to check it. I always assumed that that expression, the ties that bind, was some literary kind of quote, say from T.S. Eliot or Shakespeare or something. But when I checked out the origin of that phrase, I was surprised to find that it apparently derives from page 57. Of the basic text of the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous.
Wow.
And the quote is, "As long as the ties that bind us together are stronger than those that would tear us apart, all will be well." So I'd always assumed that it had some literary source, but this discovery actually relates very well to the contents of the book, which refer to connections, relationships, and family, all of which have had encounters or collisions with narcotics of one sort or another, alcohol, cigarettes, etc.
Yeah, God. Okay. That's a surprise.
Yes. So, so the gallery of characters, like Perfect Binding, there has been some falling apart, shall we say. I could, in my mind, when I look at the scenario over the decades, it to me it almost seems like a slow car crash.
In what sense?
Well. It raises questions about outsiderism, the risk of going too far out. We've got Jim Mellor's crisis of gender leading to Victoria Ashley, archetypal Lester Mod Stefan Rayner, whose self-promotion and hype bordering on megalomania, his book All About the Boy, which neatly bypasses the phase of working at a rubbish recycling depot in Leicestershire and having a virtual breakdown. The immortal quote from Steph is, "Even when I'm wrong, I'm right," which is kind of almost like a sort of an illustration of almost what's wrong with men.
Okay.
Bart, who disappeared for 40 years and was recently noticed by chance in the background of a Newsnight piece about drug rehabilitation in Liverpool. Rick Gretsch, who played with blind faith but returned to die in Leicester. Jelly, the quintessential pillhead, robbing chemists and dealing with Bob Hughes, who did time in an Australian jail for something which we should leave unspecified. David Parkinson's suicide, Sam Thompson, recent suicide, John Cramporn died of AIDS. Today's guest, Jack English Jr., whose checkered past is only sketched out in the book. Angry, occasionally addicted, expelled from several schools, associated with colourful characters in Leicester known as the Crazy Gang.
They were people that worked for bookmakers when I was working for a professional gambler, yes.
Right. But you kind of had a knack for, you would kind of gravitate towards people who might have been referred to as the Crazy Gang.
Yes.
Why were they called the Crazy Gang?
Why would they call the Crazy Gang?
Speaking to the mic.
Because they'd get up to sort of insane things under the influence of alcohol.
Right.
I remember them pulling the huge Christmas tree down in the middle of the Bell Hotel.
Right.
In Leicester, that kind of, just, you know.
And you'd go to what were the hell they called? Like these things in the country with big tents and so on. What was that? What was it called?
I've forgotten. I'm not.
Yeah, I can't remember what they were called. But anyway, but Jack is a stills photographer on movies. But you, before that, you spent time working for oil companies in Madagascar, Nigeria, and the North Sea, working for a bookmaker, and so on. And then, of course, as my father, our parents, whose story is possibly. Could be seen as a very, on a graph, it would look like a very, very slow sort of downhill passage.
It's tragic.
You're right. All of which is my unashamedly jaundiced view in counterpoint to the nostalgia fest, the trips down memory lane, as demonstrated in the recent Mods Shaping a Generation exhibition at Leicester Museum and in various publications, one of the best being by Richard Barnes, 1979, who actually interviewed you at the time.
He did.
You are quoted in that book.
Yes. I think he was a friend of Pete Townsend's.
Right, okay. I mean, I wonder if we could we run the first film clip, please? Is that possible? No? Or can we? Should we play the record first? If you play the record first, and then we could have the little film clip. that was are we on? Yeah. That was one of your choices originally.
Yes.
Sorry, Country Line Special, I think.
Yeah, by Cyril Davies. Is it Davies or Cyril Davis? I don't know.
Davis, I think.
Okay. And would that have been a significant track at the time? That's quite an early piece.
It was to me, yeah. Also in a funny sort of way, made me think of Graham Bond for some reason. It was one of the first bands I saw at the Il Rondo in Leicester.
Right.
You know, seeing Jack Bruce and Ginger Baker and Hextall Smith and Graham Bond on organ was a, you know, one of the first live bands I remember seeing.
Yeah. It should be said, I mean, you were always a bit younger than your the guys you sort of hung around with would always be 3 or 4 years older than you.
Yes.
You were pretty young on the scene.
I was.
And I was still am 3 years younger than you.
Yeah.
So this kind of...
That some doesn't
of the,
change.
No, this sort of stuff sort of filtered down to me, kind
yes.
of like, it was like a sort of something
yes.
dripping downwards, and I'd sort of be like a receptacle for this stuff and
yes.
observe it going on, but without taking part in it, because I was too young.
Yes.
But you'd be going down to London to the clubs. Which clubs would you have gone to in London at the time?
The Flamingo, the Whiskey A Go-Go, the Last Chance,
right.
the Scene.
Yeah.
The Scene, which was in Ham Yard, was where you sort of usually wound up because it was open an hour later than the other clubs, and I wanted to score more Drinamill or Purple Hearts, as they were called in those days, Speed.
At that time, they weren't actually illegal, were they?
They weren't very, very well known of by, let's say, the law.
Right. And so, in fact, some of the characters, two of the characters particularly, it's Bob Hughes and Jelly in the book, were serious dealers of pills, weren't they? Because they were... But Jelly worked as a chemist.
Yeah, they weren't serious dealers. I mean, Jelly knew a guy that worked for Butler's, that manufacturing chemist, and he used to give him, you know, a lot of pills at the weekend, and Jelly would take them, give them to us, and sell them. Yeah,
right.
I wouldn't call him a serious drug dealer.
No?
No.
Okay. The book says otherwise, but anyway.
There's
a contradiction there.
Yeah,
there's sort of stories of boxes full of these pills going down.
The shoe boxes full of them, yes.
Shoe boxes full of pills. Okay.
Benzedrine, yeah.
So it's all relative, okay.
Yeah.
Right, so he's not a serious dealer of pills.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's look at this clip. There's a film clip which you might find interesting.
Okay.
I hope we have a film clip.
I'd just like to say that I think the foreword to the book is by
it's by Dan Wilson.
Is extraordinary.
Bloody five. Another few more, and that's a lot for a Friday. £14.03 for 1,000 of these a day. No wonder I've always got a bad back. I'll soon be done. I'll have a fag in a bit. No use working every minute God sends. I could get through in half the time if I went like a bull, but they'd only slash me wages so they can get stuffed. Don't let the bastards grind you down, that's one thing I've learned. Jack's one that ain't learnt it. He wants to get on. Yes, Mr. Robbo. No, Mr. Robbo. I'll do it as soon as I can, Mr. Robbo. And look where he got Robbo. A fat gut and lots of worry. Fred's all right. He's one of them who knows how to spend his money, like me. Enjoys himself. That's more than them poor beggars know. They got ground down before the war and never got over it. I'd like to see anybody try to grind me down, that'd be the day. What I'm out for is a good time. All the rest is propaganda.
Okay. So tell me, where's that from?
That's Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, starring Albert Finney, who I think was the son of a bookmaker from Nottingham.
Right.
It had a profound effect on me, seeing that film and seeing Albert Finney in the film.
Yeah. Interestingly, I mean, I know it's probably a bit of a thorny or delicate issue. I don't want you to go into a rage on air, but
no.
Steph Rayner also quotes. He also mentions Saturday Night and Sunday Morning as having been an influence on him at the time. So it seems to be a quintessential movie, which depicts. It's almost as though, in order to be rebellious and anti-establishment, you had to be angry and possibly amoral. I mean, it's almost like, in order to get that confidence
there were a lot of films around that seemed that had an effect on me. I'm trying to remember the name. I mean, weren't they called kitchen sink dramas or something?
Well, there was the Free Cinema, which was like Lindsay Anderson.
It wasn't just Saturday Night and Sunday Morning. There were quite a few other films that also had a effect.
Sure. But the character of Albert Finney in this movie, he's quite. In fact, we've got another clip.
Richard Harris in Sporting Life.
Oh, yeah.
Also, you know.
Unfortunately, I was hoping that we'd show the clips, but we can't. It seems we can't get them.
There was a film about lorry drivers called Hell Drivers as well, I think.
Oh, yeah, with Patrick McGoohan.
With Patrick McGoohan, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, so it wasn't just Saturday Night and Sunday Morning. There were a lot of films around.
Right. But that one always comes to mind, first of all.
A film. I might be wrong in saying this, but I think a film that had an effect on the clothing, the mod thing, was Dolce Vita.
Right.
With Marcello Mastroianni.
Right. But the curious thing was that the people in those films were all much older than the teenagers, weren't they?
Yes.
I mean, people like Marcello Mastroianni, Alan Delon.
Yes.
And so on.
But they had that look.
Which is something you aspired to.
That I certainly aspired to, yes.
But so you've got this strange anomaly of like a teenager in Leicester, sort of looking similar in style to a sort of like a...
Well, yes, I was thinking about it before doing this interview, and I remember, I think I was with Jelly, and I was on a corporation bus in Leicester, and there were plenty of seats on the bus, and I had a midnight blue mohair suit on, and I was standing up, and somebody said, "Why don't you sit down?" And I said, "Well, I want to keep the crease in my trousers."
Right.
So it was sort of like, you know,
part of that perfectionism, which is the perfect binding,
which I still have.
Right, right.
I don't stand up on buses anymore, but I still have that perfectionism. There are aspects of the mod thing that have never left me.
But that mod aesthetic was definitely a narcissistic outlook.
Yes.
Do you think there are any drawbacks to that attitude?
No.
Okay. The confidence remains. Okay. If we hear the second clip, ideally we should have seen the film, but anyway, it doesn't matter. Perhaps we could.
It wasn't just Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, though.
Sure.
A lot of films.
further. See that fella? Let's go and see what's happened.
Hey, you! I saw you. I saw what you did.
I was only trying to get one of them
home. Yeah, hey, come as quick as you can to that phone box and get the police.
No, no.
Here, take his other arm.
What's he done then, mister?
He threw something through that window and smashed it. We're holding him, please.
This old baby
will know
the same. Hey, he ought to get put inside for a thing.
Don't worry, we're holding him till they come.
The rat face is. You'll get a stripe for this.
Ah, right across your back.
One in the flower vase for me mother.
That window wasn't worth breaking, mate.
Don't you talk to him. He could do all his talking to police.
Hey, you talk to them all right.
Only buried her 3 months ago. I wasn't doing any harm.
Well, you didn't have to do this, though, did you?
Why don't you leave him alone, you old bag?
Oh, you cheeky young beggar.
You'll get 6 months in Lincoln.
Oh, let me go.
I wish.
See where you are.
Oh,
yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Look at the way he's talking to her. Look, it's awful.
Walk off, mate. Nobody will stop you.
Don't put ideas into his head or you'll be in trouble.
You shut your bleeding rattle, rat face. What good is it going to do you, him over to coppers? Go on, get going, roll.
Oh, oh, come on,
come on. Come on. Come on. Come on.
And where you are. And where you are. Shut up.
All right, then what's the trouble?
This man here smashed that window. I saw him, and that woman did.
Any other witnesses?
I don't know how that rat face could do a thing like that. Because he's a fit.
That's another scene from Saturday Night and Sunday Morning.
But, it is.
But it's quite an interesting scene because at the end of that scene, he finally says, "I know what I'm going to do," and that's when he put. You see him with the air rifle.
Yes.
And he's going to shoot the neighbour with the air rifle, yeah. not to do them serious damage, but it's to sort of anyway. Yeah. But it's an interesting scene because of the. There's a lot going on in that scene where there's a guy who's seriously up against it. I think his wife has died and he can't afford the funeral fees. And he throws a beer glass through a funeral parlour window. And Albert Finney and his mate step in and they want to... The people have gathered around this guy and sort of they're saying, you know, call the police. And Albert Finney and his friends say, walk away, mate, walk away.
Yeah.
So that you've got this sort of conflict,
this
sort of moral conflict about, you know, they're saying, well, you didn't need to break the window. It's like an act of vandalism, which Albert Finney and his mate are saying, actually, good for you, mate, you know.
So there
is a sort of difficult... And in fact, strangely, later, of course, Lindsay Anderson, one of the free cinema guys, made If.
Yes.
Which now, I presume, would almost be classed as an incitement to terrorism.
Yes.
We have to backpack, of course, backtrack to say, apologise. I've been instructed we have to apologise for all the language in there, the use of the word bag and so on.
There was also in Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, he had that whole. I remember him opening the wardrobe, and he had that whole row of suits. So there was.
Oh yes.
There was, you know.
Right.
It was very important to him the way he looked.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there was the clothing was in there.
Right. Okay. But as it happens, another little story. In fact, we've got Roger Burton here in the audience today of the Horse Hospital. You and Roger. Basically started contemporary wardrobe together, didn't you?
Yes.
And as it happens, I think Albert Finney suggested the name.
He did.
Right. You had met him somewhere.
I was sat next to him by accident at a party, yes.
Right.
Or a dinner or something, yeah.
Yeah. So you met Albert Finney and you said that you were going to start, you and Roger were going to start this clothing hire business.
I think we already had at that point and hadn't got a name for it. And he said you should call it Contemporary Wardrobe.
Right.
That's how I remember it.
Yeah. And that was when your premises was on Winchester Walk in near Borough Market.
No, it was in Belgravia. I think we were in Belgravia then, in the basement.
Oh, really?
In Belgravia, yeah.
Well, I remember Winchester Walk when you were doing the sign, and I had to point out to you that you hadn't spelt it properly.
Okay.
It was I could spell it.
Maybe Roger, I'm sure Roger will remember better than I can.
You spelt it contemporary.
Okay.
Contemporary. I'm just, you know, making a claim for that, you know, just to go in the history books.
All right.
Okay.
It was Belgravia.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you. Mm-hmm. All right, member of the audience.
Roger.
Yes. Yes. I mean, I should say the film that influenced me, just as a sidebar, or it's not such a sidebar because it is my book, my favourite film of the period was Fran Jus's Head Against the Wall, made in 1959 with Anouk Aimée and Jean-Pierre Mocky, but I think we probably won't have time. And that's interesting because the delinquent, if you like, or the guy that rails against authority in that film is condemned to a psychiatric hospital by his father, who decides that he's been stealing from him. Right. So it's quite a dark film, I think, you know, compared to the British films, anyway.
What was the French film where the guy runs up to the sea? Because you always quote that at me.
Oh, that's the 400 Blows.
400 Blows, yeah.
Truffaut. Yeah.
I don't know what period that was, but that had a...
I can't remember, it's 50s. Peter Todd now, being a librarian at the BFI. 400 Blows, what's the date of it? Quick, no, time up. Okay. So James? No, okay. 58, 59, whatever.
He had a great look as well.
Jean-Pierre Léaud.
Yeah, he always had a good look.
Yes. It always reminded me of when you ran away from boarding school.
Yes.
In Scarborough.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Let us play... What have we got next? Oh, yes, let's play this next track.
I'm looking for time.
I see you watching me just like a hawk. I don't mind the way you talk, but if you touch me, something's got to give. I live the life of love and I love the life I live. My diamond ring and my money too. Tomorrow night they could belong to you. The girls move me at their will. I live the life of love and I love the life I live. I may lay 100 on a bet this time. Tomorrow night I can't cover your dime. Next week I could be over the hill. I'm just trying to tell you people how I feel. You see me rocking as I pass you by. Don't talk about me cause I could be high. Just forgive me if you will. I live the life I love and I love the life I live. On a bet this time. Tomorrow night I can't cover your dime. Next week I could be over the hill. I'm just trying to tell you people how I feel. You see me rocking as I pass you by. Don't talk about me cause I could be high. Just forgive me if you will. I live the life of love and I love the life I live.
I can't think. Mose Allison.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, sorry. Yes, great track.
Mose Allison, who was a big influence on Georgie Fame.
Yes.
And in fact, this comes.
And The Who.
Oh, really?
Young Man Blues.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I think. I might be wrong.
No, that's right. And you, is it reasonable or fair to say that there was a degree of self-destruction with this whole... I mean, you know, that you enjoyed The Who smashing up equipment.
Yes.
Young Man Blues, it's all about sort of... Yes. You know, and so on. But there were other aspects which are touched on in the book.
Yes.
I think.
Yes.
How does that figure with narcissism? Or is that too broad? I mean, it's probably like
It's too broad.
It's too big a question, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
I mean, obviously, you know, in those days, I saw all the great bands, and was, you know, I think I saw Pink Floyd at Loughborough Art College. I mean, it was like it was like that, you know. But I mean, I saw the Who originally, and Townsend, you know, hitting his guitar into an amplifier to get feedback and that kind of thing, and then eventually smashing the guitar up. I mean, sort of, I'd never seen anything like that before, and it kind of appealed to me. I thought it was a really interesting way to go.
But do you think it sort of
did it have an effect on me? Yes, probably.
Well, I was going to say, I'm going back to the Albert Finney character again. I don't know. I'm sort of stuck with that one in a way that in order to be, he's in a factory and he doesn't want to work in the factory. And at that time, it's like in order to get out of that treadmill,
yes,
you had to be somewhat insensitive and angry, and it required a great degree of confidence to get out of it.
Yes,
which could also be detrimental. It's like there was no way of...
Well, he didn't get out of it in the end, did he? He got married, and they sat... I think the film ended with him sitting with his future wife on a hill in Nottingham.
Okay. Well, and that's worth pointing out, that it was set in Nottingham.
Yes.
And the book is ostensibly about Leicester.
Yeah.
So there was an identification there with the environment and so on.
Yes.
Because it was...
Plus, I'd held down brief jobs in factories.
Right, yeah, but you were determined that you weren't going to go down that route. So you had a fairly wayward life, I suppose.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and constantly rebellious and fighting against any authority. I don't know.
Right. Right. You have to interview me.
I have to interview.
Ask me something about the book. Oh, we've got this, but we won't play this. I tell you what, we'll play the next track, and which is your choice. And that would allow us to talk about Rick Gretsch.
Okay.
Turn more than you gave.
Okay. Well, that's yeah. That's Traffic.
Yeah, Welcome to the Canteen with Rick on it. And Rick lived with me in the...
Hold it there a second, because Rick is Rick Gretsch. And yeah. There is a passing reference to him in the book, because there's a photograph of Jack and Rick Gretsch in 1964. The Leicester Topic, which was a local magazine, showed sort of teenagers dancing in a nightclub, which was called the Pit.
Yeah, that was under the Bond Street car. Huh?
Yeah, the Big Beat in Bond Street. So there's a young Rick Gretsch and a young Jack English, and Rick Gretsch played with the Farinas, and then Family, and then eventually Blind Faith
and Traffic.
And Traffic.
That track was from Traffic, and right. It reminds me of, I know Rick. Lived with me towards the end of his life in the flat that Roger mentioned earlier in Belgravia. Mm. And you know, he was in pretty bad shape in those days.
Right. In bad shape how?
Well, heroin addiction and alcoholism had kind of taken its toll.
Right.
Although, you know, he was still very up, very kind of positive.
Yeah.
Which is extraordinary. He had that kind of personality. But I remember being in Holland with you, and you being commissioned to do a drawing of a place where I was working. It was a sort of restaurant set in the middle of the pine forest, and you sat there working, and you had the radio on next to you.
Oh, yeah.
And the Blind Faith track came on. I think it was called Sea of Joy.
Mm.
And I remember thinking at the time, that Rick, he's made it. He's got out of Leicester, and he's done well. He's made it.
Right. Well, it was an absolute pinnacle of any, you know, it was a super group, which ended badly.
Yes.
And he then played with the Crickets, I think, and Graham Parsons.
Yes.
And he ended up going back to Leicester.
Well, basically to die.
Right.
That's how I saw it.
But if you read the little, reading little précis of his life, it seems like he was an impossible person to work with, and kind of they couldn't keep him in the group because he was so.
It was a full blown addiction. Yeah.
Right.
Mm. But I remember having this white suit made at Hoggett's, and I remember him asking if he could borrow it for an audition once.
Right. Did he get the job?
He did.
Okay. Yeah. So, something to be said for the white suit. Yeah. Okay.
I always wanted to look like I'd just come back from the south of France.
Yes.
I'd sort of off-white suit made.
Right. Okay. We should remind people, actually, today's event is to launch this book, Perfect Binding, which is a sort of memoir artist's book. Hard to define it. In a way.
Well, the foreword is a very good definition. The foreword is extraordinary and very well written.
Right. The foreword is by Dan Wilson, the designer of the book.
Yeah, and I mean, could you describe in any way the influences that the people that you mentioned in the book or featured in the book had on you?
Well, I think the book is the influence in a way. I mean, the book is my statement. I mean, probably haven't said very much over the years. You know, it's like a sort of very slow drip feed. It's like something dripping down, and then there's an accumulation of stuff, and then you just think, well, perhaps it is worth recording. It's hard to know if it's going to be of interest to people who don't know Leicester, I suppose.
Does that matter?
Well, it doesn't matter to me. No,
I don't think it does. No,
I just have to go with it. There might be three people in Leicester who are interested in it. We've sold a few copies.
It's an extraordinary book, Will. It's an extraordinary piece of work.
Thank you.
But when I mentioned yesterday on the flyer, you'd mentioned Boy in relationship to Jim Mellors, and I thought...
You were worried by that.
No, I wasn't worried. I was just interested in your opinion of Boy.
Ooh. Perhaps we better play the next record.
No, I think you should give your opinion.
Boy, I have absolutely no interest in Boy whatsoever. Steph's big thing was his attitude. I liked Steph, whatever the period was. I mean, it was his attitude. He was barred from the street. Dave Parkinson's father said, I don't just not want him in the house, I don't want his car on the street. He just wanted him away because of his attitude, basically, which can be seen as a handicap or a virtue, depending on your point of view.
Right.
We're going to end with a desperately uncool track by the Monk Brothers Quintet, who used to play at the Hungry Eye, which was a Leicester's first pancake house. And interestingly, Sonny Monk, who played in this quintet, then started up Leicester's first vegetarian restaurant, which is called The Good Earth, and actually still exists. And I think it's sort of, we haven't got much time left, but we could say that I think that seemed to me like one could almost write another history of the people in Leicester who created those spaces where teenagers went.
You know, like Pete Joseph's, you mean?
There's Pete Joseph's with the Chameleon.
The guy with the Bond Street Cafe,
the Il Rondo. They're almost like people who created spaces in which this sort of action could take place.
Yes.
But they disappear from view, almost like they didn't exist. And all that's left are the actors, as it were. But okay, well, that's probably it for today. Thank you very much to Jack for coming in and helping me out with this. And
thank you for asking me. I'm sorry, I couldn't have.
It's okay. No, it went well. We'll end with this. I think one of the tracks might even be called "Everybody Knows the Hungry Eye," but it doesn't really matter. We can just play. We'll just play anything. Thank you.
This program has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.